On this week's episode of Word Labs Out Loud, we're playing part two of the panel conversation From Page to Stage, Voicing Your Verse, a workshop that was offered for free as part of the 2025 Spelling Park Arts Festival. The voices you'll hear in this recording are the headliner for the 2025 festival, Cadence Weapon, also known as Rolly Pemberton, Kingston's poet laureate, Sadiq Amir, and vocalist and spoken word poet, Jermaine Marshall, also known by his stage name, Jay Marsh. I've recapped a little bit of the conversation just to give you a bit of context, but if you'd like to listen from the beginning, you can check out our archives, or if you prefer, you can catch past and future episodes of Word Labs Out Loud in a podcast format on our website at wordlabs.ca or via cfrc.ca.
That's a really good point about how when you're channeling the universe and just experiences, you never know who it's going to resonate with. I wonder, have you ever had a moment where art you've made has resonated unexpectedly, audience-wise, or in a way that surprised you in terms of who was really kind of picking up on what you were putting down?
Yeah, I have an example of that. I have this song, and I'm very proud of it. It's a song I made with this guy, Jacques Green, in Montreal, and it's called Night Service. And it's the way we wrote it is kind of this melding of, it's a lot about like dance music history and culture, club music history in New York with the earliest DJs. And they used to call this one DJ Larry Levan. Mm-hmm. His DJ nights, they called it Saturday Mass. Mm. And it was like a religious experience. And so I use that as kind of a jumping off point to kind of cross some religious imagery with like the club imagery, right? Yeah. And it's really funny, like I never forget, this person reviewed the song or something, and they referred to what I was doing as like, and they're like, wow, this is so interesting. It's like electronic music with gangster rap on it. And I was like,
all right,
this is not the correct kind of music that I'm doing here, you know? Like. It's very like spoken word, very poetic, like gentle tone of a voice too. Mm-hmm. But it was just because it is rapping. Mm-hmm. They were like, oh, that's gangster rap. Yeah, I'm not like Ice Cube like right now, you know. It was very chill. So,
but you, anything, you know, did you look back on?
Yeah, like with books, reviews can often play that role, right? Where I'll read a book review and they can come out quite a while later and then understand, oh, that's what I was doing, you know. Because I do think it's actually not, I think, my job to analyze to that degree my own work. I don't like to be, I think creation is something different, you know. Mm-hmm. I want to be aware of it, I think, as hard as I can about it, but like there's a level of looking that belongs to other people. Mm-hmm. And when I hear back from them, usually it's really illuminating. There's this one very random moment in a review where there's a poem I wrote that involves an echocardiogram. And so it's a scan, it's called the imaging department. It's of the heart. I'm trying to describe the human heart. Mm-hmm. And then I read this review and was like, and when she has her first look at her baby on the ultrasound, it's like, that is technically very mistaken. So I don't know whose responsibility that was. That's, I think, the only time when I was like, no. Yeah.
I absolutely adore how you said that there is a level of looking, a lens of looking that belongs to other people when it comes to your work. That, you know, you literally can't access because you're not those other people, and what it's like to be in conversation with that, because looking at reviews can be also very stressful, but it can also be something that gives you an insight, because I've gotten feedback where I'm like, it's not positive feedback, but it's accurate feedback, and I am glad that I was told this, or I became aware of this way in which my work or my words or my music was operating. It was, so it's interesting that you mentioned heart, because I wanted to, if you had anything that you wanted to share, we're getting into the part of the afternoon where if you wanted to share a little thing or two, so you know, get primed up. Okay. But I got to thinking about something else that was a feature of my childhood, which is theme songs. You know, watch a lot of TV because I wasn't allowed to go outside because Jamaica's dangerous and people are getting beheaded and there's a gang war going on. stay indoors. And so I used to watch so much television, and it was interesting how the theme songs and the music gave me mantras to reaffirm the self that I was becoming, even in very hostile environments. So I have a thing that I'm thinking to share, but I see that you've gotten a beautiful purple book.
Yeah, this is my purple book that was published.
Your beautiful purple book.
It's called Bedroom Rapper, and it's a memoir. And I actually have a whole chapter about lyricism. And it's from when I was poet laureate, and kind of how that impacted my my songwriting and lyricism and poetry and stuff.
Would you like to read us an extract?
Yeah, I would like to read an extract. Lyrics can be playful, powerful, painful. Listening to the legends and fables of the hip-hop stars I idolized, it seemed like you could really change the world with some well-placed words, or at least change some minds, change some lives. That's what happened to me when I first heard Pharoah Monch, Pasta News from De La Soul, Ghostface from Wu-Tang, and Aesop Rock when I was a kid. I appreciated how all the raps had different ways of expressing themselves. The way you rapped was just as distinctive as your penmanship and just as difficult to copy. Rhymes over a beat can be like an incantation, an electric burst of magic with limitless potential. But ultimately, lyrics are a form of communication, a vehicle for sharing ideas, memories, and emotions. It's about both grasping for the intangible and tapping into the collective consciousness. It's oral storytelling, and it's also a way of making sense of your experiences and the world around you. Lyricism is a synthesis of life. Even mainstream pop songs have ideologies and perspectives that inform them. Lyrics can be impactful. Rap verses are often used in criminal trials as if they were incontrovertible evidence of real-world wrongdoing and not examples of artistic license. I've seen careers ended with one line. I've seen lyrical beefs escalate into real-world conflicts, but I've also seen lyrics lead to outrageous wealth and fame. Part of what makes songwriting feel magical is the fact that even if you repeat the methodology behind making a hit, it might never feel quite the same when you try again. Despite what the pros in Nashville and LA might tell you, it isn't an exact science.
I love that. Non-exact science. Sadiqa, is there anything that you wanted to maybe share with the room? It's also fine if you want to percolate on a piece, or maybe not this time. I should have asked before, I apologize.
No.
Do tell me to fuck off, I need to fuck off. I give you license to do so.
It takes a lot for me to swear. Oh, that's funny that you say that though, because, okay. Mm-hmm. I did bring a poem that I thought I could read, and it's the only one where I used the F word. See, I'm a mom, so I'm like, shall I read that?
Please.
Okay.
Also, I'm now thinking of the next book, Moms Don't Swear. A guide to mom etiquette.
I'm a dad, and I think we're all allowed to swear, right? You can swear.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Something
beautiful about artists swearing in church.
Yeah.
True.
I swear in church a lot.
Moms Don't Swear is bound to be misinterpreted as a title, so that's my book. Actually, there's a thing you said in what you read about how, like, something like the way each rapper rhymes is so distinctive to them. I would say, like, if I have one thing to say about sharing your work, it is, like, voices are so distinctive, literally, right? It's amazing to me sometimes how much you can remember someone's voice or tell it after years of not hearing it. So use that, like, what's really, really yours. I think that's the best way to translate what you've written, is how do you hear it in your mind? Don't imitate other people, what they sound like. Like, bring it out of you. That's what you want to do.
Yeah, and I think embracing voice play, that as kids where we're used to kind of playing around with our voices and how we want to sound, but then oftentimes that gets weaned out as
yeah.
we are. Like, no, you have to sound proper. Like, oh. the onus to sounding proper is a killer of your own creative voice. Mm. Like, sound silly. Be around people who let you sound silly and just kind of... I have a lot of voices, and it sometimes weirds my friends up. They're like, no, this is still me. It's just, this is how my mouth wants to move.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, this poem, I chose it today because we were talking about that idea of who's listening. This is a poem that I wrote based on both of my brothers trying to get through customs at airports over the years. And the feeling, like, the spirit of it is sort of like, here, I'm offering you up this experience. And then thinking of the unsympathetic, possibly, listener, the listener who can't possibly love my brothers as much as I do, I take it back at the end. So the poem sort of speaks in and then away from the listener. You will know what I mean, I think, when I read it. It's called Brethren Flight. Look at him, awaiting scrutiny. He's as foreign as you make him. Already robotic lenses swivel. Perspiration's his constitution, was there in the damp boy who surrendered in the laundry to a nap. Were you never sheltered where you fell? I know his eyelashes. Minding is luggage enough to secure it, but not to seem armed. He was a cabbage in a grade school play. Boarding's a perpetual audition. Now he holds his papers out too early for their talismanic work. I want you to know what he hasn't done. Hasn't asked for lamb biryani one last night, his father pounding garlic to a tabla tune. Black cardamom smoked over flames. An agent smirked, smell this one, in a prior queue. Another march through the gullet of his own nation. Hasn't asked his parents to be here. One goodbye holds all the others like a Russian doll. Opens his mother's floodgates. Ooze, Tana, Jhelum. Which river to even miss? My boy. My boy, that prescience of an ending, unaffordable. He doesn't pray, relinquishes coins, belt, shoes, rivulet on his left temple. He has been separated from his conversation with mercy. He may name his future children Blake or Jill. The profile of his body scoured of relations, which is all it takes to kill without killing. Forget it. Looking at him belongs to me. I did it for love before you ever gave a f-. I asked his tormentors, you and whose army. I left a breadcrumb trail through the briars. If he flies, look at the country forming below his relieved exhale.
How much I hate the airport.
Yeah. It's not a good place.
It's an uncomfortable place to be in. That liminal again, you know, in transit. Well, now I'm like, ooh, I don't have a book. I have wads of paper that I shoved into my back pocket because I had to print them very quickly this morning because I was running late, as I often am. But I got here early. Damn. I was the first one here, besides Paul. So this one is one that so many of mine are unnamed, just untitled. I make them and then I forget about them until I don't. So this is when I had gone to Canada to do my master's, and growing up watching the screen and, you know, projecting your imagination into other worlds because your own reality was so painful, and then getting to those other worlds and being like, oh wait, this isn't great in all the ways I thought it would be. The unmet expectations. I was a bit angry when I wrote this, so this poem holds a lot of that. Different strokes for different folks. Yet we live in a world where the waves of life push us to swim at paces and within lanes that our saltwater bodies aren't equipped to handle. Ever seeing other more elegant scales gliding in and out, weaving like thread through tapestry, as though they were born breathing water like air, or have discovered some hidden current of which we can only dream. Nonetheless, we aim for that stride, that gait of living forever feeling inadequate. Never knowing what adequacy truly means, only gleaning lessons taught by ivory idols, on flashing screens, preaching false gospels that we exalt as happiness. A happiness whose road is peppered with steel-edged rocks that draw streams of blood from unshod feet, scabbing and tearing again and again, feet desperate to rest on the coveted pedestal, if only for a moment. A moment we are led to believe will last forever, will compensate us for these crude scars and surgical sacrifices made to plow our way there. A moment that holds the greatest of miracles, that will raise shattered minds and broken hearts from the graves we buried them on our way up the mountain, singing psalms of better days. A moment that will never come, but will remain blazing in our minds as we scramble frantically forward under their whipping whims and wants until we finally burn out, leaving only a trail of ash for our children to follow. And so I find that, you know, when we each sort of read pieces, there is a place that we go to, at least I go emotionally when I do a reading. It's feeling the art, you know. But are there places that you go when you perform that is an aspect of your performative persona? Because I know that I go into a place oftentimes of memory. I like thinking back on the relationships connected to the piece that I'm doing. But are there places that you go in a performance, like a way that you present your work as opposed to write?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's different because I do different mediums, and with writing, if I'm doing a reading or poetry, I feel like it's one way. Maybe it's a little more analytical or something. Whereas when I'm performing, like I'm gonna, but yeah, when I'm on stage, I feel like it's very free. It's very freeing. It's very cathartic, and it's like a direct. It's a more direct emotional connection for me between myself and the audience, and in a way that I really don't think I have anywhere else in my life. And it's, yeah, I feel like it's an out-of-body experience.
Yeah, very spiritual.
Yeah.
Where do you go when you perform?
I mean, I started out with a lot of stage frights when I was... Yeah, I really felt like, dear God, this is part of the job.
That's a natural survival mechanism. And if you were in the savannah and there were millions of people watching you, you want to know and move. You're doing it right.
Thank you.
It's sensible.
Yeah. So anyway, that is done. Like, I get nerves like any human being about it, but like, I have really learned to appreciate it. It's the only time that a writer gets to see what their words are doing in a live way. It's so wonderful, and now I find like it energizes me to go back to what I'm working on in perpetual solitude. But I think it's okay if that's your learning curve, you know? I started out just knowing I had to, but finding it really difficult, and now I can lean into it and just, it's like a pleasure to read.
Okay, yeah. So we have time for one more question from the audience. I see that hand is ready to go.
Yeah, hi, I'm Antonia. You've talked a lot about sort of not having control over how people read or see your work, and I'm curious if relinquishing that control is difficult for you, and if so, if you have any strategies for doing it for both of you.
Yeah, it was very hard for me initially, because I think a lot of artists maybe have the same problem of being control freak a little bit. I think I just got better at being able to let things go and just kind of treat things a bit more like they're ephemeral, and just kind of be like, it's out there, it's doing its own thing, it's growing up, it's getting older, you know, it's in college now, like, you know, and it's just, it's its own
entity. Don't helicopter parent it, man.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it just takes time. I think it's just, and the more stuff you make too, I feel like I've become a little bit less precious about each project or whatever. Like, my first few albums is just like, I'm the steward, I'm the dad of it. I was like, about everything about it. And, you know, I've just made my 7th album, and I'm already just like, let's just make another one.
So the 7th album is the baby. It's like, the other albums are like, oh my God, you have such an easy time with dad.
We have a big family.
I think you probably have more experience with that feedback cycle. Maybe filmmaking is similar, like, because, you know, mostly I write books, like, I'm not there when people are misinterpreting. It doesn't bother me because I don't know it. Also,
misinterpreted distance, I love that.
Yeah, there's a delay when you write the, you know, whether it's coming out in a journal or as a book, there's this built-in delay, right? 6 to 9 months. And at that point, it's not the center of my enthusiasm anymore. I'm most excited about what I'm working on right then. You know, that's where the aliveness is. So I also, that sense of investment is a little bit faded. I know it to be a separate thing for me. Mm-hmm. And it's out there. And what I really care about is that line I wrote yesterday, which you're not going to see because I know it's going to have to incubate and take time. And
I find that for me, I don't think of it as control. I think of it more as my curiosity has always resided in, oh, that's how you're interpreting it. Tell me more. Like, let's get into it. You want to comment on my creativity manifesting? Well, your comment is your creativity manifesting. Let me comment on it. Let's have a creative exchange. Right. Because to the point of, you know, the alcohol instead of the love, like, I might get things of value, different perspectives out of it. It can be as constructive a process for me. Even if I vehemently disagree with the person, it tells me about, like, oh, there is this kind of audience out here who their pathways of thinking when they encounter my art in this way is this. Am I interested in creating art that can bypass or, like, work with that to still get across the message that they're missing in this piece? So sometimes it's like a bit of it's encouraging. I enjoy it. It's an enjoyable experience because I'm learning something.
Yeah, and I did I understood from what you said, there's being misinterpreted as kind of like, mm-hmm. that's nonsensical or like, mm-hmm. I didn't quite mean that. But you were also talking about like being misinterpreted harmfully, right? Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. now the people in your church seem like to be demonized by their behavior. Like. Mm-hmm.
But
so,
I guess
so I understand
doing,
that's
like,
important.
To the point of doing like a follow-up, I would want to ask those people who, I mean, again, I'm not ready to do it yet, so I'm not going to say it until I have that infrastructure to do that, but I would want to ask them afterwards, like, why is that what you took away? Let's talk about that, because that's part of engaging with the art. So I guess I'm one of the, I have high expectations of my audience. Yes, I do. I feel comfortable saying that, because I'm like, in literature class, we're taught to read a book many times, to fully read a poem many times. Why does music suddenly not have to be engaged with deeply?
Yeah, I'm writing a book about this exactly. It's called Ways of Listening, and it's all about, you know, trying to have deeper listening in like the era of streaming, where everyone wants me to make, you know, 5 albums a year, and all the songs are like 1 minute long or whatever, so.
I wanted to bring up something that I think is a song about perspective. Who here knows our favorite aardvark? Who's our favorite aardvark?
Arthur?
Arthur the aardvark.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is he an anteater? Is that the same thing?
No, he's not an ant. He's an aardvark, right?
Yes, he is.
He's an aardvark.
Okay. So I remember as a kid, you know, I didn't catch the theme song the first time I saw it. I caught the show and I was like, oh, this looks interesting. And then like I heard this thing in the background, like the drums, like I was like, oh, is this reggae? Like
what
reggae?
Yeah.
It's a bop, but it's also a story about this world, you know, they did it before Zootopia, this world of animals that are all different, but are all engaged in some really interesting conversations, interesting kind of disagreements about things and how they navigate that. And you'll be able to see Sadiqa and myself where? In the future?
Word Labs.
We'll wrap up this week's show by playing a song that Caden's Weapon referenced earlier in this conversation, his 2019 collaboration with Jacques Green entitled Night Service. Tune in next week for more Word Labs Out Loud. And in the meantime, why not check out wordlabs.ca and take a look at some of the fun upcoming groups, seminars, and workshops we have for you.
Thank you.
before the phone, so a party photographer tagged along. Neon beams was flashing, the DJ played the rapture. Saw the lights reflected rays, she was dressed like Chloe Sevigny. Met her on the seventh day of tour, it was going awful. On the road with 12 apostles, out there trying to spread the gospel. Started missing daylight, knew I had to stop raving. Woke up, came back to life, got reincarnated. At night service, Saturday Mass. Night service, Saturday Mass. All the nights with stained glass, in the future see the past. Night service, Saturday Mass. Night service.